Welcome today to our interview series with Outstanding Professionals. I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and I'm conducting an exclusive interview with Chris Howard, top global engineer, entrepreneur, who's passionate about transforming the world. Chris, you've got a pretty amazing career with so many outstanding contributions with Lockheed, and now with your own ventures. And I thank you for coming in today and sharing so much of your expertise and insight.
Thank you very much, Stephen. Oh, sure. Yeah, that's a long time ago, but I actually grew up in Portland, Oregon, in the Pacific Northwest, to a very nice family, a very nice family in the west side of town. And really, from a young age, I was constantly taking things apart. Really, some of my first memories involved me taking toys apart in front of my brother, trying to figure out how everything worked, and then almost getting things back together, but always remaining with the several remaining parts. And closely related to that, I always was big into Legos and building very complicated structures with Legos, even as young as 5 or 6, where it was fun to combine all the various different tools at my disposal to build giant, like, bridges and structures, some of which were several meters long, completely out of Legos, Lincoln Logs, and, you know, the standard building tools that young kids had for building things. So I was always into math and science and engineering and really neat things. Got my first computer experience when I was, I think, was 5 years old, programming for, I believe it was on a Sinclair system. I can't recall precisely, but yeah, I was just very fortunate to be in a place where I had a lot of early experiences early opportunities to get involved with technology. And, you know, related to that, I did a lot of really crazy things that I guess most middle schoolers or grade schoolers would not have done. Now, one of the probably most interesting things I did was overclock my calculator in middle school, basically doubled its clock frequency. And then once realizing that funny things were happening when the calculator was running faster, me and my friend wrote a benchmarking suite and other tools to understand why it was not calculating correctly. And we discovered that some people in the audience might know that when you run processors faster than they intend to run, sometimes you get errors showing up, particularly in floating point processing numbers. And we more or less confirmed that result and was able to write programs to measure the error associated with that. So, and this was not done with any real formal education or any real direction at that point in time. The two of us just kind of sat down, kind of self-discovered all the stuff moving forward. And, you know, I would have killed to be in the era of the internet and Wikipedia at that point in time, but those tools weren't quite out there or available quite yet. So a lot of it was self-discovery and just kind of putting together little bits and pieces from the books and other resources we had available to us. You know, other things like was trying to create wireless chat systems for out of radio parts without having any traditional RF or background, and almost getting things to work, but not quite. But we never quite understood why they weren't quite working out that way. But anyway, enough of that. So another big part of the growth was that allowed me to gain a lot of perspective and a lot of wisdom very early on was being part of one of the best Boy Scout programs really in the Pacific Northwest that I was aware of. And it was an environment that was actually very much youth-directed and adult-lightly supervised. And so we had a group of people that really very quickly had to learn leadership skills and directed a very entertaining program that everyone was able to be a part of. And because of this environment, basically the older scouts always mentored the younger scouts, and there was always energy and new ideas being interjected into the process, which made it so everyone really had value to the overall experience in the team. So, and with this put everyone, no matter where you were in the program, whether you were just starting at, what is it, about age, I think it's age 14, maybe 12, all the way to the people who are at the upper end of the scale at 18, always challenged people to learn more, either for teaching skills to younger people or learning skills from the older people, while incorporating skills from all the external practitioners that would come in and help with the program, everything from the police to learn fingerprinting and other skills to artists teaching, you know, some of the leather work and artistic schools and other things. For me personally, my expertise ended up being orienteering, which should be no surprise. And now I helped both teach and lead my troops in multiple victories for orienteering challenges. So very interesting stuff. But again, this was also a team that ended up like to always push the limits and always wanted to figure out exactly where the limit was, whether or not this was hiking 30 miles in a day, free climbing radio towers, or doing capture the flag games in steep mountain valleys in the middle of the night and figuring out how far you could push things and have fun without having people get more than superficially injured. So it was a very interesting opportunity to basically have freedom and explore and put explore limits without necessarily getting yourself where you're actually getting, you know, in a really dangerous position. So really, from here, this is a group that I thought was an excellent program, and I hope people still have the opportunity to get things where you learn great opportunities to get risk assessment, you know, basically how can you do slightly dangerous things or moderately dangerous things without getting more than superficially hurt. And by dangerous things, I mean things like mountain climbing, rock climbing, aggressive dodgeball games. You know, there's dozens or hundreds of things that you kind of involve, learning to make fires, learning wilderness survivor skills, you know, basically working with knives, riflery. There's a bunch of this stuff in there that was really interesting. As well, related to that was learning responsibility for the team, where you had to deal with people that were junior and barely entered middle school, combined with people who were getting ready to leave high school. And so you still had to get the mentality of no person left behind and figure out ways where everyone in the group could participate, even if they weren't as strong or as smart or as capable as other people, so that you could get some sort of team cohesion. And out of that, you ended up getting, almost completely like accident, basically some of the best leadership skills you could possibly have gotten at that point in time. So really knowing when to lead, knowing when to speak up, and learning when to follow, and knowing when to switch between those roles depending upon who was dominant in the team at any given point in time, because different people were better at different things. And so it was very nice to be in a flexible leadership solution where there was really no major challenges or arguments with the way things were run. It was nice and organic. It was fantastic. You know, same thing with using team creativity to solve problems quickly as a group, and really just going out there and just learning to just do it. You know, find something interesting to do that may be a little bit crazy, and then work with a team of people to figure out how you go out and get it done. And a lot of things were done like that, especially things like some of the more advanced mountain climbs that we did as a group. Also around the same point of time, middle school, high school, I was also very deep into our jazz band program, and at one point in time made basically the state jazz band for a couple of years in Oregon. And no, that was a very interesting experience, just to basically learn a new skill and music, but probably the more important thing associated with that ended up learning by association what is sometimes called the jazz fusion process, where basically you are part of a group and there's sort of rules that you have to follow, but in the end, but everyone's allowed to improvise on top of the basic structure. And even that basic structure can be modified as long as everyone follows. So really it's the whole entire concept of, especially when you're in a combo situation, if someone comes in with an idea and then then adopting the idea and then making it your own and then having everyone else in the group absorb that from you. And really what you learn with this whole entire thing is, at the end of the day, it's really you learn all the rules, the chord structure, the harmonies, the way things are supposed to be structured, and then you work as hard as possible to forget as many of the rules as possible. And really by doing that, magical things happen, and you're able to basically make incredible music out of something that on its face would look like something that would appear to be complete chaos. And that's because everyone is generally following the same rules, but everyone is allowed to modify and update those rules, and everyone is committed to following and keeping up with the group. And when that free idea exchange happens, you get some really interesting music and other things coming out of that. And those exact same ideas and concepts can be applied to many other highly creative endeavors, whether it's software, technology, art, or pretty much anything else in life. Another thing that I kind of experienced early on was being the paranoid idiot in the group. I was the one who was always asking the stupid questions and testing very advanced assumptions and ideas. And these were basically, I was a huge reader when I was young and came across hundreds or thousands of ideas. Some of them were a little bit offbeat or strange. And it was always interesting to be able to go to a group of people and test some of those ideas and figuring how far out there and what people thought of them. And while it oftentimes made me look like the wacko of the group, it really did a good job of helping to understand and put some of those ideas in context, whether they were, you know, certain things like libertarian ideals or certain emerging things with science or how accepted certain more controversial concepts were. And I don't know, I thought it was a very good learning experience and very interesting. I guess towards the end of high school, I got my first job right at the end of the first tech bubble as an IT intern at the Oregonian newspaper, which gave me a very unique and early perspective on business. And as that IT intern, I did everything from implementing a new PDF process for pre-production or for press pre-production to basically putting together and upgrading some of their early ISDN services for remote access and administration to the core services. And, you know, that just kind of fell out of always being naturally good at computers and always doing things. And, again, this is something I more or less accidentally ran into right there, where it was something that I came across that was interesting to do. So I interviewed for it and ended up going there and just did it. It was very interesting. And then that kind of covered us up through high school. And then I went to University of Colorado after falling in love with the environment and the state. And they also, at that point in time, had one of the top electrical computing engineering degrees in the country. So it seemed like a good fit for me and my background. And I basically earned my degree at the University of Colorado in 4 years. And while doing that, I participated in the Space Grant Program, helping put together the Three-Corner Satellite and a couple other satellites for the school program. And very interesting early introduction into science and mathematics. I also, the next year, I then did a internship at NASA at the Dryden Flight Research Center, where I was working with a small team of people to put together a brand new flight computer system for basically micro UAV type applications. So, you know, this is something that, you know, back in 2002-ish required full development of something that didn't exist anymore. Now you can buy the same hardware pretty much off the street for $10. So, you know, but it definitely was an interesting experience, and heck, I learned a lot from the people who had been there. There's a lot of really cool projects that were going on there at the time. So excellent learning opportunity. But to kind of get to the stories and lessons learned associated with these things, during college, probably the most challenging and most interesting project I worked on at the same time ended up being my senior project, or the capstone project, for my electrical computing degree. And I was part of a group that decided that we were going to build a tactile braille system for basically helping create more or less a display for the blind that basically you can think of it, if you can think of those pins up displays or things that you put your hand in and the pins go up and you kind of see a picture of your hand in the pins. We were making a version of that that we could that operated completely by computer control, so that you know, a blind person or someone whose vision impaired could actually feel the 3D image of someone in those pins that were being moved. And it was three-dimensional, so each one of those pins had 128 pin levels, and we had something like a 128 pin grid. But anyway, that project ended up being far more challenging than I ever expected, not because the technology was hard. We actually ended with a successful product, but because that was a very challenging team to work with, where we had 5 team members, each with completely incompatible personalities, and we had to somehow find a way to get to success. And basically, there are things where, you know, some people needed instruction on everything they do. Other people didn't really appreciate testing their code before delivering it, right before critical deadlines. Other people, one person did not believe, always thought they had the right idea even, and would always go against the team until you were able to prove that their idea was not necessarily the better idea to go, and you had to figure out the way to get them back in to work with the rest of the team. And then lastly, trying to get someone who, you know, felt overwhelmed to actually participate. And now, I ended up being more or less the moderator of this team, trying to be sure that we can get the different personalities, different people together, and that was almost more important than the core technology. And this is a team where early on, we literally had people screaming at each other at the top of their lungs in the middle of the classroom over some of those disagreements, and somehow you had to take that personality, quickly reverse it, and make it so you could deliver a final product in 10 weeks. And that was probably one of the hardest and fastest learning environments of my life, and it required basically putting double the amount of work in as the rest of the team, as well as trying to understand the needs and wants and all the team members so that we were able to work together as a group and as a team, as opposed to, you know, having one person complete the project by themselves or having things evolve into a chaotic failure. So very challenging environment. I guess after that, I then basically interviewed and somehow got hired at Lockheed Martin without any real fuss or effort. And it was at a really, it was timed really well when they were doing massive growth of their teams. And I actually got hired for a program that was canceled about a month after I was onboarded. So I then switched over to the Space Radar program. And really that as a multi-int engineer. And as part of this, I was part of the team that was in charge of taking data from multiple satellite systems and multiple ground systems, multiple aircraft systems, and putting that information together in a way that would make sense to someone consuming the information as well. So really trying to basically make sense of terabytes of data and be able to simplify it to the point where it's understandable to the end user who is trying to understand what the heck is going on in the battle space. And that actually, even though that wasn't big data at the time, that actually was is very applicable to the big data applications of the day with how everything is kind of being put together. And so that was a very awesome introduction into the world of large-scale, complex, chaotic data. And many of the challenges that we faced back then actually have not been solved by the big data approaches of today. And yeah, and I'll probably get into a lot more of my work experience at Lockheed Martin a little bit later, but you know, one of the things I did there that gave me some early lessons is getting in trouble for developing the first Google Earth-based visualization tools that basically existed. This was, I think, in 2004, 2005, right when Keyhole was transitioned from the Keyhole Corporation to the Google company. But basically, I ended up doing a cool side project and got in trouble for doing a side project because I was doing work on company computers that I wasn't technically authorized to do. However, because it was very interesting and very useful and very awesome, and it ended up being, even though I ended up getting my hands slapped for it, it ended up actually becoming a core component of multiple proposals that ended up actually, you know, making Lockheed a lot of money, even though I don't think I got any credit for it. But really, you know, it's still shocking to kind of go in and see Lockheed Martin demos and seeing code I wrote 12, 15 years ago. 12 years ago, still running pretty much unmodified on some of their demo platforms involving large-scale mapping systems. So, you know, similar to that, you know, early lessons associated with finding a, you know, security hole in a system and then reporting it and then getting in trouble for looking for that unpatched security hole in the first place, even though it's one of those things where you kind of see things and, hey, that's not supposed to be there. You know, how big is the problem? And then going down that rabbit hole and, you know, some people just don't appreciate understanding or people who are very curious about learning the details about the systems. But anyway, you know, I guess I'll finish the Lockheed Martin story right now, where I then went into doing graphical modeling for satellites. I did a stint doing sensor data processing for various air breather systems. I then eventually transitioned and got involved with big data in the company and ended up leading up the big data team for the Shark Tank team that ended up being started up there by Dominique Colt. And, yeah, that kind of takes me very close to where I am today, where I got the opportunity to take an idea and run with it. So I'm now in the process of trying to take some very advanced concepts in big data and put it all together in a way that really has the opportunity to change the world. So with all this, I guess the best way to describe the summary of this is basically always ask why things are done in a specific way. If the answer is just because, it's that something can probably be done better, or you can find ways to improve the efficiencies of something. And that can apply to, you know, and a lot of that has to do with business processes and trying to make business processes make a lot more sense, or, you know, figuring out ways to make computer and electronic systems better. And, of course, and related to that is that always seek how to make two or more things that can be combined. There's always the opportunities to combine multiple ideas and multiple concepts to make a single whole better. There's no reason why you have to always treat a large projects in terms of component A, B, C, D, E, and F. There's always ways that you can combine it and simplify to make a better overall product. And a lot of that comes to the proper way to do software engineering and system engineering to make things as efficient, graceful, and supportable in the long run as possible. And, of course, lastly, is just figuring out the right ways to push policy boundaries to make things faster, better, cheaper, but being careful never to push things that will annoy the customer, break laws or contracts, and figuring out exactly where that line is, because there's always opportunities to make things better and to push the system to accept change, and quickly learning to figure out when change is possible and when change isn't possible, and figuring out through all the complex politics. So, you know, technology is easy. It's process, and getting acceptance of new ideas is hard.
Now, Chris, that's just a really diverse, considerable list of accomplishments that you accomplished earlier in your career. And you're also an authority on big data, data fusion, cybersecurity, net-centric warfare, and other areas. Because of all of this background that you have, really, really globally ranked background, what are some of the top trends that you see, and what can enterprises do?
Well, sure. First, fast data will rule everything. Fast data is really the emerging concept that is the next step beyond big data, and it's really involving, and the best way to describe it is the fact that you need to be able to not only be able to work with terabytes of data at any given point in time, or zettabytes of data, or exabytes of data, you also have to make decisions on that data really quickly as the data is coming in. And as many organizations have discovered over time, the older the data is, the less value it actually has. Now, it still has value, but the older the data is, its relative worth decreases. And the fresher the data is, the more value it has. And this is compounded with the challenge is that the things that are producing the data are producing it at exponentially increasing amounts. So this has to do with the explosion from, you know, you're probably going to see, you're already seeing 4K cameras and cell phones. You might say 8K cameras and cell phones. And basically the data grows from the data generation side versus what the data grows from being able to get that data from where it's being generated to the central storage point is ever shrinking. So this kind of more or less forces you to do things in the fast data environment, whether you like it or not, because you don't have the opportunity to put all your data to a central location to process it in the first place. So because data growth is increasing incredibly, networks are going to start to grow, are going to continue to grow slowly, but never at the speed that data production is going to change. And the fact that you're getting to the point where it's becoming quite easy to push more and more of your fast logic towards where the data is being generated in the first place. So really, this kind of changes the model from doing a centralized big data approach to a highly distributed fast data approach. And this really fundamentally changes the data architecture that most businesses have available to them, as well as gives an opportunity for companies that are a little late to the big data game to potentially jump ahead of their competitors by enabling them to basically put the decisioning logic where the data is being generated in the first place to basically almost make business decisions in real time or milliseconds as opposed to the seconds, minutes, or hours that you traditionally would have taken for big data systems, or the weeks or months that it might have taken for someone who's using traditional systems before, basically companies that are pre-adopting big data type approaches and other things. So really, it's really a different type of big data processing that we're dealing with right now, where instead of building your machine models on a central environment, testing it, and then pushing it to the live environment, you almost want to get to the point where the analysts are actually working with the real live data as it's streaming in and being able to be instantly alerted when, you know, something interesting happens on your data stream and you don't know what to do with it. You need to have all the tools and capabilities in place so analysts are able to react to it almost immediately. So really what it comes down to is that businesses are starting to realize they need needs that are very similar to what has traditionally only been in the industrial or military type settings of the need to be able to make sense of terabytes of information at a time and immediately making decisions against it, whether or not that's a regularity in sales that will all of a sudden show up at a particular store in a particular part of the country, and being able to react to that within a few seconds. If you have a fleet of vehicles, being able to run diagnostics on a single car, understand why that car is operating in an irregular way, interactively between an analyst at a central location in that vehicle, and then push some sort of algorithm to detect that irregularity out to every vehicle in the fleet and be able to do that very gracefully and quickly in a way that does not have the traditional weeks or months or delay that normally can occur in those kind of things. So really, basically, the faster you can make the business decisions, the more advantage you're going to have as a business, and the tools and processes and capabilities are getting to the place where that's going to become very accessible to most businesses, and that's where things are going to get really interesting very quickly across pretty much every single domain. And yep, and associated with this right now is that really, combined with the fact that you need IT data, businesses also probably should start to take a look at thinking of things in terms of intelligence analysis. Intelligence is your business intelligence data. It's your sales data. It's your competitors. It's your it's the weather. It's really whatever relevant information is associated with your business and your value stream and how you understand how that's translated into some sort of business operation. Basically, when you're starting to pull all this data in real time and filtering and trying to make sense of it, you really have to start to adopt practices that really start to look an awful lot like multi-infusion. And the concept of multi-infusion, where basically data analysts are working with data live as it's coming in and making decisions as it's coming in, and not only having to understand, you know, basically what the data is, that something interesting has happened, why it's happening, who's involved with it, and other things, and being able to determine what's worth paying attention to and what's not worth paying attention to. So really, I believe there's going to be a lot of interest in transferring a lot of the traditional intelligence analysis skills that have been developed by many of the governments around the world and very quickly transitioning into the business space, because really, from my personal experience, many businesses have kind of stumbled into the space accidentally without realizing that, you know, many of these basic approaches and processes were pioneered in the 1970s, and no, there really has not been enough communication between the various groups that have involved with these different types of data processing and figuring out the right way to put things together. So huge opportunities for doing technology transfers and real opportunity for companies to very rapidly get ahead of information processing processes far beyond what some of the leading government groups are doing right now, and there's a real opportunity for businesses to get ahead of where the federal, state, and other organizations are, and really start to take a leadership in this space as the tools and needs and business needs and information systems have finally caught up and are starting to get ahead of the traditional, fast data communication, net-centric warfare type environments that these are involved with. And this also puts a concept that, from my background, called TPED, tasking, planning, exploitation, and dissemination, as part of something that can almost be treated as a core part of a business model in many organizations. And really, how that works is that you can imagine you have a fleet of UPS vehicles, all of which have GPSs attached to them, all of which have packages, and you're trying to optimize package delivery across all those vehicles in real time, while reacting to snow events, weather events, traffic events, traffic accidents, stolen packages, et cetera, and people dynamically trying to figure, and then on top of that, people dynamically scheduling things like package pickups or other things that might might cause interruptions to initial plan, and be able to deal with organizing all those activities in real time. And of course, these organizations, a company like UPS is already kind of doing some of these things real time, but that kind of approach is really becoming more applicable to almost every single group. So to kind of get back to what TPED is, it's really tasking, creating a plan for all those trucks ahead of time and planning what order they're going to deliver things in, while understanding that there's a closed loop where that tasking and planning could be updated at any given point in time. All those trucks that are on the road are going to be generating data. So how do you use that data to update and optimize things further? And then how do you get that data to where it needs to go to all the downstream users who are not necessarily part of the planning loop but really have a need for the data? And for in a package tracking example, that would be someone who's like you as the user trying to track where your package is, or you as the logistics manager trying to understand how optimal the trucks are, or trying to understand how long the packages are going to be delayed. There's lots of different examples of that, but it really comes down to really a model and challenge that can be applied to almost any, everything, even whether you have a physical presence or just a virtual presence. And, of course, naturally, with more distributed data, with more fast processing, with more computers everywhere, and computers are now your cell phones, IoT devices, and everything, comes humongous security challenges. And there's always a huge trade-off between security and worker efficiency, and trying to figure out what that right balance is crucial in this business space, because basically according to the recent data that I've seen, pretty much every company and every major company in the U.S. has been infiltrated in some way by some sort of either external or internal hack. So the question is that, and then you associate that with the challenge that you have no edge to your network anymore because of all these brand new cloud devices and things that are coming in here. So there's a humongous gap between the intrusion systems and the security system that exists today and the real world need. So basically, how can you deal with the balance between locking down the system to the point where workers can't get anything done and being sure that no critical data is being stolen? And this is a challenge that almost no business has figured out the right way to deal with because it's so incredibly challenging to work with. And, you know, really it comes down to understanding how valuable is your data and how do you prevent, how do you create, strike a balance between these two concepts? And, you know, this is even further highlighted by all these wonderful hacking as a service type environments and systems that have been set up where even 8-year-olds who are playing multiplayer games on Xboxes are now going to websites and paying criminal organizations to run DDoSes on their on the enemies that was on their personal enemies or those competitors on the Xbox thing so they can get the higher score. That's not hyperbole. That's happening today where it's really easy to go out to a website and have someone do a distributed denial of service on someone for, you know, for pennies or just a few dollars. And these systems use millions of computers that have been connected to this criminal network to do remote attacks and remote hacks. And, you know, the fact that you have 8-year-olds figuring out how to use these networks themselves only shows you how easy it is for pretty much anyone to get access to these kind of tools these days. And many of these computers are actually sitting within corporate and company networks, and it's a, you know, really weird emerging world that's coming out there right now. And then, of course, associated with that security challenge is needing to encrypt everything as a standard. And encryption right now is the only protection method that we're aware of to properly protect data. And the way that people get access to the encrypted data is through keys. And how do you control, and really through careful key management and careful encryption and separating the data across multiple networks are the only real approaches that companies have to continue to keep data reasonably safe or in the hands of as few people as possible so that you always have control over who has your data and who's doing what with your data at any given point in time. And this has become really challenging, especially with some of the more recent political things, where if you put backdoors into your encryption for some reason, such as like anti-terrorist or for anything else, not only does the government have a backdoor to your data, but also criminals can also utilize those same backdoors to be able to get everything, and you just have to look at the history of the Clipper chip to really get an appreciation for the challenges and things to be keep a very close eye on for dealing with what is the right way to balance this encryption versus the need for government to be able to deal with problematic assets. And it's really challenging because it's the ultimate dual-use technology. You know, encryption makes your business considerably safer and more effective in managing and controlling on who gets your data for what reasons at what times. So at the same time, that same encryption can enable bad people to do bad things. So how do you properly deal with that balance between those two extremes, especially when you're dealing with legal and regulatory requirements? And the solution is not what UK and US government's talking about right now, which is to put huge backdoors in the encryption thing. The real solution, of course, is to get better partnerships between federal organizations and companies so that you can get a workable self-reporting system in there without compromising the safety of your core business data. But of course, and then, you know, good on that topic. And of course, lastly, you have the challenge of basically the internet being everywhere. you know, IoT devices are kind of in their infancy right now, but now that smartphone hardware and a smartphone class hardware is becoming as cheap, if not cheaper, than traditional inexpensive 8-bit micros, you basically are to the point right now where you're putting a full the power of a full desktop PC in millions and hundreds of millions and billions of new devices that will be showing up all around the world, all connected to the Internet. And that completely changes the way you collect data. That completely changes the way you deal with security. That completely changes the way you really interact with and have to manage your data streams, because basically instead of your data being in one controlled place, it's, again, distributed between a large number of devices on a diverse topology. So basically it makes managing the data incredibly challenging and very interesting, while at the same time giving you access to data streams that were unimaginable 10 years ago, especially when you're looking at things like some of the emerging technology in the IoT space, which is things like beaconing, which I suspect is what's going to be most people's introduction to the big data space. And just to explain things, beaconing is the practice of putting little Bluetooth beacons all around a store and using it to detect when, for example, when your cell phone gets near to the beacon, it can emit a signal, and the cell phone can react to it in some way. So if you walk in front of if you walk in front of the toothpaste aisle, a beacon can say, "Okay, your cell phone's there," and you stopped in front of you looked at Crest longer than you looked at Colgate because that's where you stood, and you kind of inferred that information, or you just want to figure out how people's actions are flowing through various different stores, or if you're the NFL, you know, what interest does someone go in, how many times do they go to the restaurant, how many times do they go to the food stand, how many times do they go to the concession stand or the product store. So really, beaconing is just a way that you can get a lot of very interesting opportunities to both understand user behavior better as well as react to user behavior and to get some competitive activities. And that's going to be a huge growth area that is probably going to be seen in 2016 now that those capabilities are built into pretty much every Android and iOS device in existence right now. It just has had a slower technology rollout than I would have expected it to have.
Chris, I'm just amazed. You've given us such an exhaustive, detailed sort of analysis of the trends that are out there, and I know our audience will very much appreciate it. You know, there's so much noise out there as well. You know, there's good information and bad information, and because of your expertise as this recognized authority, highly respected worldwide, and even at such a young age, what do you see as the top resources that help you in your work?
Well, you're right, Stephen. The world is very noisy, and it's becoming, and it is still challenging to extract the signal from the noise of the background, but I have been able to go and find a number of very useful resources that, you know, is more or less where I get my information and news feeds from, and a lot of it has to do, and of course, when looking through all these feeds and information, the key, of course, is to read between the lines and understanding what people are really saying, or to, in the back of your head, always be cross-referencing information to ensure that, you know, information that might have been tweaked to someone's point of view or perspective can be unskewed and put into reality. So with that, one of the most useful resources I've probably come across right now is a combination of specific websites, in particular right now, Reddit and Ars Technica, are probably the two websites that I find the most useful, just because the community, people that are involved with that, and the quality of the content is generally fantastic. And basically, if there's a technology trend out there, you can always find people who are who have touched it and be able to get in contact with them. And while at the same time getting access to the experts, being able to take a step back and understanding what the general community consensus and understanding of these very complex topics are. So it's really finding places where the experts are both viewing the data, so you have the opportunity to interact with them, as well as getting the larger perspective of, you know, what people think it means. And then, of course, then you take on top of it the general news to see how it's being translated for the mass public as opposed to what's really happening, because there's always a disconnect between, especially, you know, science and technology, and then how it's reported to the general public and understanding that gap as well. And closely associated with that, there's a number of fantastic podcasts out there that discuss many of the core topics out there these days. And, you know, many of the podcasts, and that can be anything from And of course, those podcasts are great for getting additional perspective from areas that you may not have had before. You know, everything from many of the fantastic NPR broadcasts, from you know, Freakonomics to Planet Money to things such as Dan Carlin's Hardcore History, as well as, you know, things of How It Works, Science Friday. There's a number of really high quality podcasts out there that are really good for getting a large number of perspectives on a number of different topics, and being able to get perspectives that I would not normally come across in my daily life, especially when it comes to complex technology and social issues that may need to have some sort of bridge or divide, because it's not becoming a simpler world. It's always becoming a more complicated world, and we have a number of legacy systems out there that are not necessarily the best fit for where society is right now. So understanding how to address that gap and understanding where that gap is always a fascinating topic to think of, and always collecting information, getting an understanding of. And then related to that, of course, is another great resource are meetups. And if you're in a large city area, meetup.com and Eventbrite and several other places are great places to figure out places to actually meet professionals in a number of different areas. And in my area, which is the Denver, some of my favorite meetups right now are the Tech Riot meeting, which is the emerging Internet of Things community that is growing out here. You have the New Tech Group, which is basically a large group on entrepreneurs in the Denver, Boulder, Fort Collins, and the area keeps growing right now. And then we also have the Big Data Group in the area that is really good for understanding the large data context and the activities that are going on in the big data and science communities. And there's a number of associated groups with that that are more closely related to universities and other organizations. I've got a lot of really good resources and discussions out of the Big Data, not the Big Data, okay, it's the Data Science, yeah, there it is, the Data Science Association, sorry about that, in the Denver area. And basically they've, they're more interesting because they're also very concerned about the sociological implications of big data and what it means for society, and then combining that with data research, because, you know, there's a whole host of really interesting data science and challenges associated with that. So, there's a whole large number of sociological issues that big data changes, especially when it comes to privacy and invasiveness and, you know, the whole entire where is the creepiness factor lie, how far can you push data collection, and where is it going to go, and how is that going to affect things in 5 or 10 years. Very interesting. And, of course, tech conferences are also another great resources, mostly for the people, not the sessions. I've had some of my best conference discussions just finding random people at a conference and having conversations with them and testing ideas, whether or not you just find people from companies that you're interested in, and you try to sit down and have conversations, because most of the professionals will want to have those conversations. And that's where I've had some incredible luck of finding people from companies like Microsoft, GE, and Digital Globe, and numerous other ones. And then Google is always a good resource, because, you know, you can find everything, and when you know how to use Google, especially Google's advanced search, you can do an incredible job of finding information ridiculously quickly. You just have to be very careful with Google filtering the results. I like to have Google unfiltered state as possible, because by default, Google will try to filter the results based upon what it thinks you want to see. I personally want things de-skewed as possible, so I get an understanding of the real data. So it takes a few tricks to figure out the right way to be sure Google is giving me a generic set of results, not a set of results that tailored to me. And that way you can get a much better diverse set of views and diverse set of information to help understand topics as you come across them. And, of course, as far as the technical side of things, great resources I've had are for AWS, being able to quickly spin up cloud environments to run experiments and do them relatively inexpensively, being able to hack together things very, very quickly with Python, and a lot of good luck with combining that with things like Docker and virtual machines and a few other things to be able to very quickly, you know, take an experiment from my personal PC and throw it out to 100 worker machines out there on the cloud to, you know, run on a much larger data set that's been sharded. So that's kind of tools, but I think the number one resource that's more or less helping with everything is really personal fitness and being able to just give outside and let my brain integrate on problems. And most of the fitness stuff I do is really the solo stuff, you know, biking, hiking, climbing and really just areas where you can go out without your cell phone, without any distractions, and just sit back and think and enjoy. And it's amazing how well, really what the ideas and clarity you can get when you're able to step back and just be able to walk and be able to get your ideas to kind of gel and put together, because, you know, getting integration is very difficult to do in best of circumstances, and, you know, really everyone has their own approach for it, and personally I find fitness is probably the best way that I've been able to do to help get blurry ideas and turn them into executable ideas.
Again, just a great list of resources, and really curated by a top expert, so very valuable to the audience. What do you see as some of the top opportunities that are out there, and why do you believe they are such great opportunities?
Well, right now, probably the top opportunities out there right now, I think the biggest one right now is cybersecurity, because the current model is horrendously broken. And you can see that right now because of the fact that there's lots of churn in the industry, and newcomers seem to have a significant advantage over the established players in the space by and large. And that's really because the traditional model of how you approach cybersecurity, especially with the blurring edge, is really completely falling apart. And really, it's pretty much understood that a completely new solution is necessary in the space in order to get the companies the defense that they need from both the threats inside their networks to the threats from threats outside their network, and from especially the threats that are coming in through all the new interfaces and channels that employees are working with company data. So really a huge opportunity for rapid innovation in the cyber domain, just because it's an area that is very understood to be ready for a monumental improvement. And I believe that companies are starting to really understand the holes in their cybersecurity challenges and are really starting to take it seriously too. So it's a very interesting area for a rapid growth and innovation over the next couple of years. Same thing, closely related to that, as I discussed before, really the cloud moving to the edge of the network, as opposed to the cloud sitting at the center of the network. And that's more or less going to be forced, because the data that you want to have access with and want to interact with, you do not have the bandwidth to necessarily get that data to a central cloud to do traditional data science activities with it. So all the tools, technologies, and capabilities necessary to handle that transition from the centralized network to the fully distributed network is really going to take a front seat in innovation. And I suspect that's probably going to get really hot around early 2017. However, there's going to be a lot of interesting early experimentation in the immediate future. And then associated with that is the command and control networks that's necessary to be able to manage and understand and do data science on real-time streaming data as opposed to centralized data at rest. And that's a lot of very interesting science and data science and capabilities to be learned in that space, to transition all the wonderful capabilities that have matured for, you know, traditional Hadoop-type deployments and convert them to fully streaming fast data approaches, where not only can you make decisioning on the data as it's coming in, but you can change the way the decisioning is done in real time with centralized command and control from a central team of analysts. So very interesting opportunities there. The other thing that I'm going to see that I'm looking at right now as one of huge opportunities in the space right now has to do with how you deal with the next generation workforce now that traditional employment is starting to very quickly evaporate in a large number of areas of the economy. So basically, we're emerging from an employment economy where someone is typically will work for a company for 30 or 40 years before they retire, and instead we're moving to the point right now where basically the companies are getting to the point of having just-in-time labor, where basically you have a business problem and you treat everything as micro-projects with temporary hired labor as opposed to using internal company resources that have been sitting on the shelf. So how you deal with that next generation workforce, and how do you deal with both the curation and education of that workforce, as well as being able to connect the best workers for the right job for the right time for the right reason. And I don't think anyone's quite come across a workable, the best model for that yet, especially when in the computer science and data space. And I would be very surprised if there's a breakout of some organization in this space in the next year or so. for, especially in the computer science side of the house, I think right now for at least the, like, certain verticals, there's been success in that space, especially when you look at things like Airbnb, look at things like Uber, to a smaller extent, things like TaskRabbit and a few other things, but I believe it's going to get much larger in your future when you're dealing with how to match the right person at the right time with the right skills, and be able to basically convert labor to a huge continuous series of micro projects so everyone's a contractor as opposed to everyone being an employee. And I just see that trend accelerating, especially with what the millennial generation has been forced to deal with given the labor situation, very challenging labor situation across many of the different disciplines where they've been contractors by default, or being a contractor has been the norm, not the exception for especially the younger generation. And associated with that right now is that really now that we have all these great digital resources that are out there like Wikipedia, like OpenCourseWare, like and many of the micro academies that are starting up, they have 10-week accelerator programs on specific topics like, like SecureSet's security, cybersecurity program, or Galvanize's web tech development program, or, you know, there's numerous of these things that are out there that are run by accelerators and other organizations where really the most useful skills that people can learn are either being self-taught or being taught in micro-academies as opposed to a traditional university setting. And now that you can get more or less full access to courses online and all the materials related to those courses, there's a huge, really, the traditional university model is quickly becoming slightly obsolete with the exception of the opportunities to make the personal connections and having access to some of the complex labs. But really, it's getting to the point right now where everyone on Earth who has access to the internet has access to almost the same educational resources. And that is, and then combined with the opportunities to do short, targeted programs as opposed to full university courses, usually really significantly reduces the cost of getting a top-tier education that companies will pay top dollar for. So really, the university and education model is very quickly changing and very quickly flattening to become more accessible and fair to pretty much anyone in the world who wants to take advantage of those resources. And the tools and processes to help with that transition, I suspect, is going to be a major. It's been showing up in the last. It's going to be a major trend that I suspect more companies are going to start up in the space and take advantage of, as well as organizations where university degrees are going to become less important than micro certifications, or even better, your GitHub portfolio is your interview and your experience, not your university degree. So it's a very quickly changing world.
You know, earlier you outlined your history, you know, from an early age, and there's one thing that's very consistent, Chris, in your background, and that's innovation. Whether it's innovation as a young person through your college years, post college, into your early career, to your current startup that you're leading today, which is very disruptive and on the edge in terms of innovation itself. So you're known for innovation, and I'd be interested to know what kinds of innovations interest you.
Well, sure, and I'll just go over a very short list because I'm interested in pretty much anything that there's cool data about, but in particular, I'm really excited about the new space race and the fact that it's finally possible to get private enterprise competing or exceeding the capabilities of nation states. And I'm really excited because space is the final frontier. It pushes us to develop a lot of very interesting, complex technology over an accelerated time period because you're facing an environment where you're being faced with constant new challenges that no one's ever solved before, but there's always opportunities to innovate to fill that need to do things that no one has ever done before. So really, it's really refreshing to see that we actually have a real push between SpaceX, Falcon, and Armadillo Aerospace, and a number of the other companies that are out there who are really helping to push and disrupt and get space as a first space technologies and space exploration and space processes as a really interesting opportunity to really rapidly get some very interesting rapid growth over a compressed period of time. And as part of that, I'm now confident that we're actually going to see manned Mars within the next 10 or 20 years. It's no question that's going to happen. We finally have the right tools and capabilities in place, and I'm happy that that this technology can now be pushed by private investors, supported by the government, as opposed to the government leading the charge and having private contractors support that model. So it's nice to have some real innovation, real innovators who don't have the standard congressional or legal restrictions that are put on them to be able to go out and just push the art of the possible. And the other area that I'm very interested in that I haven't mentioned before right now has to do with some of the incredible improvements that are going on in the world of genomics. And we're to the point right now, and this is something that people aren't aware of, where if you are a biologist, you can actually go out there and design a piece of DNA and then have it printed out on a glorified inkjet printer and then insert that DNA into a cell and do something with the cell. And this is the point right now where we're actually on the cusp of actually being able to do genetic engineering, true genetic engineering, not genetic kludging. So really, we're getting to the point right now where we're almost able to program biology like you program a computer, even though the computer operates in a very, very different way than, you know, traditional electronics. But we're at the point right now where as soon as we understand a better job of how the various different chemical signals, GATC, convert into, you can arrange those to express various different activities, you're to the point right now where we're almost to the point where we can almost design life from scratch, test those different ideas, print them out, share it between those worlds, between a number of different universities, and start to really get some incredible acceleration in the biology space. And you know, many of these innovations right now are very much in their infancy, but they're incredibly useful for doing things and will really allow us to, basically instead of how things are done today where you combine a DNA from species A, put it into species B, and then try it in billions of combinations and find that one combination that seems to work, and instead more or less engineer it from scratch and almost design it from the beginning and be able to design it like you would a piece of software or a piece of code. And that is just mind-blowing to me, and that's both very awesome and exciting, especially with solving a number of the world challenges, such as food shortages or pollution or how to deal with bacteria to eat pollution. It's also very scary at the same time because that same that's like the ultimate dual use technology can very much get into a cause humongous problems if you ever get someone with who wants to do bad things very quickly and do things like modify viruses to do really nasty things. So it's like all technologies are dual use, but really that genomics is and next generation biological engineering is just absolutely fascinating to me, and I encourage anyone who's listening to this call to keep abreast of many of the, innovations that are coming out on a daily basis in that space. It's, fascinating.
Chris, you've already have discussed innovations, and you've talked about some of the trends that are out there. Now, you are also this amazingly talented engineer, and it gives you an interesting perspective as you look around the world. So no matter what the domain, maybe you could expand your view of what you see as the top trends coming up in the world today.
Okay. Well, from the biggest perspective, at least from the original thing, is that the biggest thing that seems to be affecting everything right now is the idea that privacy is really disappearing, if not gone completely, in the digital world. And a lot of people have not fully appreciated or understood this yet, but especially if you look at the younger generation, there's really no longer an expectation of privacy. There is the whole entire concept that it's by default you share everything about your life, and you really have nothing left to hide. And that is a very interesting perspective, and that really touches everything that people involved with, whether or not it's your browsing habits online, whether or not it's the way that advertisers interact with the people, whether or not it's the way that you go in and are able to basically generate have companies be able to generate an index score for pretty much everything in your life, from your credit score to your educational capability, to your employability, to how good you are, or the likelihood that you're a terrorist or not. So really, the whole entire concept of privacy is gone, and the fact that this has already happened, there's no putting the genie back into the bottle, so the big question is so what? So, and that's so much, and unfortunately that's not a prediction. Basically, the prediction probably in that is that privacy is already gone, And the question is that when will society realize it, and how will things change, and what will become of it? And that's, yeah, so that's kind of where that idea is going. But associated with that at the same time is that probably data isolation is going to continue to become a real issue, because with this increased amount of information and the lack of privacy, it makes it that much easier for people to only see what they want to see. And basically this makes it so that people by default like to see things that they agree with. They like to have friends that are similar to them. They like to be associated with things that they have relationships to and have close relationships with. And with this information and big data, you have the ability to all of a sudden isolate yourself without realizing you're being isolated, and so you miss the vast a number of vast perspectives that may not be necessarily visible to you at a given point of day. So basically, the prediction is that data isolation is going to start to becoming critically interesting, and it's already starting to really show up when you look at how, especially like the very left-wing Democrats and the far-right Republicans don't even share any common news sources anymore, and they've got completely separate data streams, and that trend is just going to expand out to more and more subgroups across the population, and it's going to really increase friction as opposed to decrease friction until something happens that forces people to get into environments where there is more unskewed or more focused information. And the other thing is that, of course, associated with that is that advertising is going to continue to get more invasive across all spaces because of the additional information that people have, especially when beaconing becomes the default as opposed to the exception when it comes to the app. So people are just going to get very used to the idea that they go to that the moment they step foot in Walmart, they're going to get coupons to Safeway. The moment they step in front of Crest toothpaste, they're going to get coupons for Colgate. And et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And if not only the tracking companies that are utilizing that data, governments are probably going to be looking at that data too. So are people okay with that? What's going to happen? How does that work? And then what happens if foreign governments start to look at that data without your permission and do things? And there's already been this has already happened in isolated cases, particularly with things like the gay social media networking apps that have had foreign governments look at the data and then harass people who have been utilizing the apps as they enter the country because they don't because of their sexual orientation, etc. So I suspect that these things are going to increase. But yeah, but of course, the top it's really hard to come up with specific predictions because there's a lot of things moving forward right now in parallel. And again, really, it's automated everything. If you can't automate it, it will be automated. So that's going to dramatically affect up to 75% of all jobs across all sectors. So how is society going to be able to adapt to that automation change? Because, really it's getting to the point where it is possible to automate almost everything from office work to paperwork to legal applications, and that's really going to completely change the way that labor needs to be structured to maximize corporate profits. And you're already seeing a lot of this automation, of course, in the factory domain, where what used to take 1,000 people to run a factory, now you can do the same thing with 2 people. So how do you deal with these kind of things? And then I guess the other approach right now is, of course, activity-based intelligence, real-time decisioning is, of course, going to start to take the front seat to almost everything that's out there.
Chris, you are constantly working in development, software development, and building prototypes and so on. I'd be interested to see some of your ideas around this, and are there any promising new areas?
Well, sure. And right now I have talked a lot about big data and moving cloud to the edge, and that's really where my focus is right now because that's where I think there's the largest opportunity, the most fascinating opportunities to all of a sudden be able to get the information you need to make significantly better decisions in pretty much everything by going to, I guess the best way to describe it is a sensor-driven economy. And this is very closely associated to an idea called data omniscience. And really it's the idea that data is being generated everywhere, very little is being captured and utilized today, and we will always have more data than we can store, and the gap between these two is always increasing. So how do we extract the right information from the right place at the right time? And I kind of put some context on that. In 2011, 1.8 zettabytes of information was created globally. And that is information is probably going to double, has doubled each year, and it's probably going to continue to double each year. And that basically means that, to kind of put that in an even better perspective, there's about 1.7 megabytes of data being generated per data. No, sorry, 1.7 megabytes of data being generated per person per second by the year 2020. And given how badly we're underutilizing data today, how are we going to make all this sense of this humongous exponentially increasing amount of data that's being generated? And basically, there's a huge gap between the traditional approaches and where they need to be, and that's kind of where I think a lot of the most interesting prototypes are having to be built. The same thing has to come with the operational needs of those systems. So I guess at this point in time, right now big data is still relatively immature technology, and it's already cost prohibitive to move technology processing from like a Cloudera to a Hortonworks to big data distros that are out there right now. It's becoming even more complicated to be able to port things from like the streaming domain to the fast data stream, and it's going to be even more challenging when you're going to, and really there's no real model in place right now for rapidly moving data from a batch processing environment to a streaming processing environment to an edge processing environment. So really, the prototypes in the space really come down to how do you deal with both getting the capabilities to where they need to be at the right time for the right reasons, while maintaining the central command and control necessary to be able to rapidly change the ways that things are processing in reaction to real-world events. And it's how do you take the data-driven economy and take it to the next level by changing the decisioning timeline from days to from hours to days, and change it from to milliseconds to seconds, and what you can do with those types of improvements. So that's kind of where a lot of the interesting ideas and prototypes around that. And the company I founded recently, called Crisplody, was founded to start to experiment and look at challenges in the specific space that I've just discussed. And right now, to date, we've more or less developed a prototype that does many of the general ideas that are common between all the problems that's associated with this, but the experiments that I'd like to be able to run are specific applications of technology for challenging space, whether or not that's cybersecurity, self-driving cars, aerospace applications, even trying to figure out ways to make like smart watches and smart computing and cell phone data flows better, because all of this high level concept plays into all these different places. And to kind of get to more specific of what those prototypes are, basically these prototypes all involve separating workflow from algorithms, so that you're able to define the workflow separate from the algorithms or functions that you run on top of those workflows, which allows you to do a much more intelligent way of sharding the processing across various large number of devices, while at the same time being able to utilize the same concepts and code across the data infrastructure, from your slow data to your big data to your real-time streaming data, with basically the same concept and same components everywhere. Combining that with a service catalog where you can centralize all this information and capabilities that are available, so they can very rapidly be picked up and utilized exactly where they need to be used at any given point in time. And that can be done with a human in the loop, or even done with things like neural net or automated or logical trigger-based mechanisms for enabling the system to react to unexpected things as they happen, and be able to tune your existing data streams to be able to ensure that you're always looking at the data that's most valuable at any given point in time, and while at the same time being sure that you're always maximizing the use of your bandwidth, because bandwidth is the critical bottleneck in all these different new applications that we have right now. So how you prioritize the use of that bandwidth so you're always able to maximize information gathering. And this is really challenging, where you may have 10 or 20 sensors all competing for that same bandwidth. So how you dynamically tune things across a single device and a cluster of devices to be able to understand, to be able to maximize the amount of information that's being generated by those devices. And to kind of put some concept on that, a specific example of that right now, let's take the cybersecurity example. So assume that a company is storing all the packets that are transferred over the network and storing them in some sort of big data centralized database. You know, let's just say if you're HIPAA compliant, you probably have 3 to 6 months of packet data already on disk right now that you're collecting as part of the regulatory requirements. say on that stream, one of your edge devices says that something unusual is happening on the network and you need to take a deeper look at it. Okay? So the analyst goes in, figures out what the unusual event that triggered that alert occurred, understand why that alert was triggered, and then run that alert on pretty much all of the stored packet data that's in there, so they understand, so they're understanding, have they ever seen that alert again? Is it something new? Is it something old? And with that, they can create an algorithm that detects when that weird event occurs. And then from there, they can now take additional actions. Now they're able to detect when it happens. They're able to then do the follow-up analysis action to understand, okay, who is it? Why are they attacking me? What are they trying to get? And there's different approaches they can take for that. But let's just assume that we want to push that capability so that we're able to stop it the next time we see it coming into the network. Okay? So we now can put that exact same capability into our central catalog and then pull it and run it on our streaming data environment. Okay? We're now stopping that information the moment it hits our network at our local information, local system. But we don't want to see that data even on our traffic because it's causing quality of service to being reduced for everyone who's involved. So let's actually take this exact same capability and push it to the edge of the network. So let's actually take the same algorithm that detects and blocks the network and push it all the way out to the telco. Okay, now that attack never even gets to our edge devices, and we no longer really have to worry about it. So that's really the whole entire concept. And then being able to then adapt that so that you're able to both detect that specific event that's coming in that's maybe negative, and then maybe start to be able to modify its parameters so you can capture things that are related to that attack, maybe not exactly match it. So that's kind of that portability and flexibility of having an algorithm that you can very quickly move from the batch domain to the streaming domain to the edge domain is really the area of expertise that really the area of experimentation that I really greatly enjoy playing with, as well as figuring out how to create the central command and control necessary to be able to allow for a series of continuous experimentation and parameter variation on those components so you can continuously generate actionable data in real time on that data as it arrives in the network and not have to deal with some sort of after the fact analysis or analysis that may be seconds or hours slow. And this kind of analysis becomes really important if you're trying to like analyze things like, you know, all of a sudden earthquake occurs, and getting the right processing out to be in devices so you can collect scientific information about an earthquake in real time, reacting to, of course, when like a terrorist event occurs, and being able to reconfigure your information gathering that's close to that event so you're able to gain as much information about that event as possible in real time and be sure that you don't have to deal with after-the-fact analysis, and you can get as much information about that event in real time as possible from any device that you have connection to. So really what I'm getting to, this is really the core concept and core capabilities necessary to make the world a smarter place, whether it's for self-driving cars, whether it's for smart city, and a number of different other applications. So really, that's the area that I'm most fascinated in playing with right now, just because there's so much opportunity for rapid growth and innovation in that space, and numerous different applications that I haven't even thought of, or no one has ever thought of yet. And, you know, it's just a really interesting place to experiment with. So really, it's coming down to the concept of being able to package capabilities, move the capabilities to the right place at the right time, be able to do almost continuous real-time A-B testing on all the data as it's entering your network, and being able to enable the decisioning on all that data in milliseconds to nanoseconds. And with that new type of information, adaptability and flexibility, you know, what can you do when you can make decisions in milliseconds that used to take you hours or days? What does that mean? And, yeah, I'm really interested to experiment in space because I don't know the answers to those questions.
It's fascinating. You've done a lot of research in this area. In fact, your work is unique globally. Have you applied for patents?
Yes, we have. So we've recently applied. We have patent pending technology in the space that I just described, and we're currently planning to. That patent right now more or less covers doing some of the optimization techniques that's required to deal with the competition of bandwidth and other resources when you deal with these highly diverse environments. But that patent is really intended to help us get our feet off the ground and be able to get this get some of the core concepts popularized around the industry. And our intention in the long term is to take many of the experiments and capabilities that we're developing right now and make many of the course more capabilities open source and accessible to everyone, because we believe that that's the only way that we can really help popularize and accelerate this approaches to market, while at the same time being sure that our as a company have some protection over areas in the environment to at least allow us to get our foot in the door and be able to popularize approaches in a way that's credible and reasonable. So,
Chris, you're quite famous for being a seasoned developer, very efficient, highly productive, with capabilities spanning many, many different areas. You know, we have many developers in the audience, so can you provide some of your top software engineering and developer tips?
Sure, yes, I can. What it comes down to is that I'm just really going to keep these really at a high level right now. So, and it really comes down to doing proper system engineering for all your software development and understanding how the piece of software that you are developing fits into a larger world, or potentially will fit into a larger world as you're doing the design. So, and by doing this, by both understanding the context of your code as well as the content of your code, allows you, it may slow down your ability to write raw code, but allows that code that you write to be relevant for a longer period of time and generally be higher quality. And, you know, that comes down to several different specific points. So basically, you define what's good enough and where that good enough point is, so that you always know when to stop optimizing or when to stop coding and work on other projects that are associated with it. Because when you're working on something cool, there's always a habit of wanting to make it perfect. And the challenge is figuring out when is it perfect enough to throw over the wall to make it accessible or usable to other people versus trying to get that last, you know, that last bit of performance or that last bit of capability out of that section of code. So understanding what's good enough and where that 80% and getting where that basically everything is 80% is really challenging for pretty much everyone, because of course as all engineers want to make things perfect and wonderful. The other thing that's really key to software development is decomplexify as much as possible and write the best code you can with as few number of interfaces as possible. Because the more interfaces and configuration points you have, the more complex your software product ends up being. And that complexity makes it orders of magnitude harder to test. And that decomplexification can be really challenging, especially for larger scale systems. And it really requires a lot of discipline and discussions with everyone involved in the software development project, not just the software developer, to create the design that enables that reduction of interfaces and complexity so that you're able to get the simplest product possible and much more quickly arrive upon an optimal solution, as opposed to a kind of kludging stuff together and basically the mud ball approach, where you take a piece of software and you just throw more stuff at it and you get a bigger mud ball. And it works for a while, but, you know, basically it's coming down to trading off early program cost with long tail costs. And the more time and effort you can put on to thinking about things end-to-end at the upfront, which increases upfront costs but decreases tail end costs, really does a great job of making longer term, more stable code. And associated with that is fighting for good UI. And UI is really, really, really hard. And you can't easily A-B test it, and the users won't necessarily tell you what you need to have. They'll just tell you whether it's good or not. And the other downside is that it's not acceptable to have a complex interface to just assume that once people have ordered the app, they're there forever. So being able to hire and put resources in the UI even early, even at the beginning of the project, is critical, because it is very much more of an art than a skill. And getting UI is ridiculously hard, and I'm disappointed that UI is actually getting worse rather than it's getting better, because a good UI you should be able to utilize without thinking or really having to learn it. It should just be intuitive. And that even when you're doing ridiculously complex operations, you can still have intuitive interfaces. So being focusing on that and getting to the point right now where like a brand new user can utilize the app almost as effectively as an expert user is really the gold standard of where things need to be, whether or not it's for an internal engineering app or whether it's for a new social media smartphone app that someone is inventing. It's really damn hard to get right, and I really think it's really underappreciated for a lot of projects. And related to that, the users are always right. If users can't use your product, it's not the user's fault. It's it's probably your fault, and you can probably do something better about it. So while a single user can't be wrong, a collection of users are probably right, and if a sampling of users don't like a particular design choice, it's a good idea to revisit that design choice. So very similar to the idea of the customer is always right, where a single customer is wrong, but if people aren't buying your product, you're probably going in the wrong direction. Same concept.
Chris, you have encountered many different challenges throughout your career, and some of them having global impact. So I'd be really curious to see what some of these challenges are and how you were able to master them.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think right now one of the largest challenges I've ever come across has been more social or political, not necessarily even technological, because on the technology side, unless it violates the laws of physics, nothing is really impossible. Some things are just really, really hard, and there's usually a path that you can stand out that can get you to where you need to get to, unless you need a fundamental breakthrough, and then it might take a little bit longer, or significantly longer. But I think the most challenging thing I've ever done was basically invent a job position at Lockheed Martin without any management intervention, and then fulfill that role. And the position I created for myself and filled myself was the Shark Tank Big Data team lead, where I was somehow able to, by utilizing process and the way that labor charging was conducted and a few other things, I was able to define the role that enabled me to basically have 15 or 20 of the top big data practitioners within the company as part of the network, and at the same time utilizing that myself and that network to be able to influence and touch probably over 100 big data and sensor processing projects around the company. And as part of this, I even ended up being a special advisor to the director of big data, which supposedly at the time was the highest authority of strategic decisioning in the company. So really it was, yeah, so really being able to do that, work through the policy, understand where the policy holes were that allowed me to do that, and be able to get the right management via the right leadership and connections and relationships in place to make that possible is really interesting. And I found it really amazing that I was able to turn that made-up position that didn't appear on any org chart into something that ended up directly influencing the big data strategy of a $7.8 billion a year business unit. It still blows my mind that I actually pulled it off. So anyway, associated with that, to get away with that, I needed to know exactly where company policy ended and legal requirements began. I had to be sure I was connected to the right networks for top cover, particularly when the actions of my team made enemies by doing things better than the traditional networks. People don't like to have their jobs threatened. In order to get away with that, I had to network like crazy to be sure that I always had a supply of work and charge numbers that I could utilize to cover the salary that I was forced to cover for myself. And then associates, I also had to have a direct supervisor who allowed me to get away with things. And at least I was able to find two supervisors I was under who, as long as I was always able to get a charge number and didn't cause him any personal heartburn, I could basically do whatever I want. And that was a really important thing to be able to have. But of course, the most important thing of all this right now is being able to so closely associate with like-minded disruptors. And that was accomplished through the Lockheed Martin Shark Tank, which was started by Dominic Holt and Ingemar Flores, who I believe, Stephen, you've interviewed previously. And yeah, they did a fantastic job of being able to help work and enhance many of these top cover and executive connections necessary to make this kind of disruptive organization, unofficial disruptive organization, possible, and create ways to survive when we made massive chain of command violations within there. But as part of that, we basically helped establish or kick off about over $1 billion of business a year, or at least we touched over $1 billion of business a year through these activities. So at least we had enough success, we were able to justify those actions for a while. But really, it was really quite that's really a good description of something that on the outset seemed impossible. If you'd asked anyone ahead of time, people would have said that was impossible. But really, that's probably the most challenging, disruptive thing I think I've ever done, and got some really fantastic and great experience out of that, and really helped me mature my understanding, especially for how to work with executives and government policy and company politics and a number of different things all in parallel. So that's definitely the biggest and most challenging thing I've ever done. And yeah, I'm disappointed that situation wasn't able to last due to a number of different things. You know, we were too disrupted. There was a management change, and we basically the top cover decided not to protect us as much as they probably should, and the 2 or 3 year window we had to do that kind of evaporated after a while. But that was one of the best learning and experiences I ever had, trying to build and accelerate technology growth across the company with some of the most amazing technologies imaginable.
So I know that you're also involved in a lot of fiscal activities as well, where you've gained a lot of insight, and it's a big part of your life. What important lessons can you summarize from all of this discussion of you just talked about now?
Well, with all these things right now, it's really knowing the limits and knowing the line. And where does policy end and where does the law begin? When can you get away with being insubordinate? And generally, if you're doing something to make things faster, better, or cheaper, it's shocking how flexible policy can be as long as you're doing it in a way that doesn't violate contracts or piss off customers or other things. But again, you just be aware that you're operating at risk. And really, it's going back to the whole entire idea of knowing the rules and then forgetting them. And then very closely associated with that is being sure that you are reliant on the team, but you still have the ability to be fully self-reliant. And that's something that extends for both business as well as a lot of personal challenges of knowing what your personal limits are, how far you can push yourself, how much you can do yourself, and knowing when other people can do better things than you can, so that you can build teams that are all self-supporting and are in order to enable you to do some incredible things. And whether that's ridiculous physical challenges, things like 24-hour adventure races, or being able to do things like basically do some build new systems that have never been invented before. And then, of course, what I'm trying to say is that really you have to know yourself. Know how far you can push. That's really something that people don't really know how to do. And basically, when you push too hard, bad things happen, whether it's in business, whether it's in physical fitness outside. And really knowing where that line is of where you're operating at, when you go from being safe to when you're operating at risk, when you're operating at stupid, and being sure you can back it up so that you're always managing risk and dynamically adapting that as the conditions change. And, of course, that can be done. Of course, one of the easiest ways to explain when that happens is, when you're out there mountain climbing, where, you start, the sky's blue, you're going up, there's a few puffy clouds in the sky. Okay, you look up over the ridge line, and there's a storm coming. Okay, you're three-quarters of the way to the top there. Do you actually run to the top at risk where you might get hit by lightning, or do you retreat down and wait for the storm to pass for a few hours, or maybe even have to give up the climb anyway, but guarantee that you're safe? And figuring out when it's appropriate, and being able to figure out and being able to judge how quickly clouds are coming, when the risk hits, and when to make the decision of a go, no-go decision is something that really has to be learned almost through personal experience, and pushing the limits, but without actually exceeding those limits and getting yourself into a real dangerous situation. It's a really challenging balancing point, and that's probably the most important lesson that I'm continuously learning even today with the new domains that I'm getting involved in. And related to that is knowing when you are not thinking clearly or making gut decisions, not data-driven decisions, and understanding the consequences of those actions. So in many situations, you are forced to make a decision where both decisions on their surface look to be equally good, and you just can't sit there and hesitate. You have to go out there and make a decision and make it quick. But you still have to remember that you made that decision that may have been the wrong one at some point in time, and be sure you can always backtrack and go to the other way and quickly and carefully take corrective action. So it's always acceptable to change their mind as long as you get to where you need to get in the end. And in many cases, it doesn't help to sit there and analyze. It always helps to run forward and collect data to push forward to the second decision, but not be so committed to it you can't go back in reverse direction, quickly move to something else, because even when you make the wrong decision, as long as you're collecting data, you are better off than where you started, even if you made no decision in the first place. And that allows you to make incredible innovations ridiculously quickly. And again, associated with this is that how do you push your own personal limit and your team limits without directly competing yourself, without directly comparing yourself with others? Because you're as long as you're always pushing in new directions and making records that improve upon your previous records personally or as a team or as a group, what everyone else is doing out there really doesn't matter all that much, because because that comparison can oftentimes lead you down incorrect paths or lead you down to pushing too hard or even adopting inappropriate or incorrect things. As long as you're individually pushing in the right direction and continuously self-improving, and you're self-improving at a rate similar to what other peer groups around you are self-improving, if not faster, you are definitely on the right track. So, again, you're probably never going to be the best at the world at something. However, you might end up being third best at the world at five different skills instead of one skill, and that might actually be better than being the best in the world at that one individual skill. So, no, it's really just figuring out how to push your limits without directly comparing yourself with others and only being sure that you're always self-improving upon yourself. And, of course, related to the previous direction there is, you know, never be afraid of senior management in a large organization. The larger the organization is, usually the more candid conversations you can have with the senior or with the senior members, and they can even help you push through very challenging things that they're not able to push from their level, especially for things that might be insubordinate or things that involve trying to change the company culture and the ways of doing things. And then related to the idea, the best way to be able to get access to those kinds of people is to be close friends with their executive assistants. Flowers, freebies, favors, whatever works, basically. Company executives is not nearly as hard to approach as many people think they are. You just have to know which ones have the ability to influence the area of change you want to be able to influence. And I guess lastly, the thing to keep in mind right now is that as far as lessons is, disruption always has unintended side effects. Even when you're making things faster, better, cheaper, with less risk, oftentimes there's collateral damage you never thought of ahead of time, oftentimes involving the people that got obsoleted by these improved processes or improved things. And these people like job security and the predictable, and oftentimes will fight you. Even management will fight you, even if you're making things something twice as good, because the new and uncertain is always worse than the tried and true. So how do you be so that is always something to keep an eye on and be able to manage, because innovation causes disruption, and disruption impacts the way the current state of doing things. And so managing that appropriately is very important. Otherwise, you'll make enemies that can potentially even prevent you from doing any innovation in the future. It's a really careful balancing act, and that kind of disruptive type activity impacting existing business can be seen, things like Uber and the taxi unions or the medallion systems or Airbnb in the hotel industry and city councils and what you're allowed to do with private property or not. So, yeah, this disruption really is showing up in numerous different areas in society.
We're going to switch gears for a minute and talk about computing as a profession. And, you know, there's some really interesting things happen. You had sort of this Dieselgate. You had the Sony hack. You had this Xcode ghost problem that Apple had, and so on. You know, there's a number of sort of events around the world that draws attention to computing, the ethical practices involved with regards to computing, and so on. So do you feel that computing should be a recognized profession on par with some of the others, like accounting or law, with demonstrated professional development, adherence to the code of ethics, personal responsibility, public accountability, and quality assurance? And not necessarily credentials, because sometimes that creates a lot of controversy, but at least those elements, code of ethics, personal responsibility, public accountability, quality assurance, recognized credentials, and demonstrated professional development. Do you think there's value in those items?
Well, I think it really depends on where you're looking, and depending on the types of systems that you're looking at, different standards are appropriate for different areas. So for safety critical coding, I think as some sort of, for anything that involves a safety critical system, that could be anything from a motor vehicle to a medical device to to an airplane, or things that basically where a mistake in the code can directly result in a safety or a danger problem to other people, it's probably a good idea to have some sort of formalized process in place and certification in place so that responsibility can be taken as well, and most importantly, being able to get the bottom cover necessary so that there is a productive whistleblowing element if management is trying to override ethical needs of other people. But I think really, as far as computing is concerned, this really goes with an idea of a larger need for ethical business practices and the ability for people to bring up things that aren't right or cheating the system to be able to do things appropriately, because you need to be able to have because companies need to fundamentally be willing to operate in ethical means to accomplish their things, because going through these processes, you have most of these problems with the incidents that you've cited, especially the VW incident, are not isolated incidents. It's basically from a culture problem within the organization where cheating to meet a larger goal ended up being successful, or hacks that were done on a temporary basis ended up becoming permanent, and the software developers that were originally in charge of the code that ended up being utilized in the cheating device weren't necessarily in the position to make the decision to take that code that may have been an engineering experiment and put it into the final production code. So it has a lot more to do with, so when you're dealing with complex systems, there's a lot of people touching the systems and a lot of people who can make decisions that can negatively impact things that may not end up being directly connectable back to the original coder. So it really comes down to how do we enable a culture of being able to encourage businesses to be more ethical while at the same time enabling people to talk out and have resources and abilities to have appropriate whistleblower pipelines for enabling investigations when unethical things happen. And I think a lot of this can be handled entirely in the private sector. Maybe we use a little bit of encouragement from legal resources, but again, there are ways to do this. For example, Lockheed Martin had one of the best whistleblower programs that are out there, where they actually had an external company available that you could call at any given point in time to report ethical or management or HR issues that would appropriately do an external a review of things that were going on, so that in a way that allowed you to correct issues without having to go to the outside press or outside media in a way that allowed for independent review that was defended all the way up to the highest level, so that you could actually, things happened such as unethical behavior by the next CEO actually got that person out from the company. As long as you instill that into the company culture, you can get rid of a lot of the absolute need to be able to do this, because, again, coding is a combination of hundreds of practitioners and it's a lot more than an individual person. Now, associated with theory, there's a lot of interesting ethical things that kind of get in the gray area that we might need to be able to think of and get addressed as well, such as ethical hacking and penetration testing, encryption, safety critical coding. When is it appropriate to point out that a competitor has a bug in their program that is leaking data? When is it appropriate to, if a company refuses to admit that they have data exposed to the outside world, and you point it out, and they don't believe you, and then you send some of their data back to them, that company not coming back and suing you for hacking their systems. How can we create a culture that is able to appropriately take care of all these things so that the overall safety of systems as a whole can be made improved, and it's not ends up being some sort of embarrassment that people try to sweep under the rug? You know, again, I've also seen instances where, you know, companies have their medical servers hacked, and instead of reporting it and follow the proper processes, they kind of just erase the server and pretend nothing ever happened. And this is medical information that was stolen. So this stuff is happening all the time, and how do we change the culture so we're able to deal with all these digital quality assurance and hacking and other challenges and privacy and other information in a way that's productive, that grows, that's basically able to make the world a better place in terms of these things. So it's, yeah, this is a really challenging, complicated space, and yeah, we'll see how things move forward with it. And I, you know, code of ethics are probably one area where you could possibly kind of get some general guidance out there and have that appropriate for certain job perspectives. But it really comes down to a code of ethics for anyone who has a digital or compute critical system, especially when it involves a safety critical function.
Chris, again, sort of mining in, sort of getting into some of the other areas that you're involved with, you have so many interests. Do you want to talk about them at all?
Well, sure, I might as well. Now, completely away from technology, probably the area that I've had the most interesting excitement right now recently has been doing a lot of mountaineering and backcountry travel. And I still enjoy regularly kind of just, going out into the Colorado mountains with no electronics, no cell phone, no GPS. So I do carry an emergency beacon in case, but, generally it doesn't get turned on unless I get into trouble, but really it's coming from just learning to be self-reliant and enjoying figuring out ways to both push my limits and explore places that that very few people end up being able to see. And I've been able to see some very incredible things and crazy things out there, whether it's exploring, some old hard rock mines that exist up in the mountains, coming across a cabin in the middle of the Colorado mountains that looked like someone walked out in the late 1970s and never entered, and you go in there and there's like original cans and foods on the shelf, bedding is still on the bed. It's someone put a lot of effort to hike all that stuff in there 10 miles to have their little hideaway, and they just walked out one day. What is the story associated with it? So, no, really, no, and then associated with that all the time and space you have to think and deeply think about things in an uncluttered manner where you don't have, interruptions every 15 seconds with tweets and digital information and cell phones. It's nice to be able to go out and do deep things in quiet environments and where you're able to go out and do things. And I had the same experience when doing a lot of cycling. This year I got a lot into doing downhill mountain biking this year. Pretty fun, more aggressive things. Also, other things that I've gone out and done recently that have, really helped me go out there and expand is getting deeply involved in several FIRST Robotics programs. And for those people that don't know, FIRST Robotics is basically a high school program where high school people end up going out and building robots and then compete in large competitions. And it's a great way to introduce young people to technology as well as being able to learn complex, chaotic project management skills, as said, because high school students are a rowdy bunch to deal with, especially with some of the underprivileged schools that I've had the privilege of working with. Very interesting people and very diverse perspectives.
Again, because of all of your expertise and your wide travels, and you're so widely respected worldwide, you must have some interesting stories to tell. Maybe something that came out of your work, or maybe outside of your work. Anyways, do you have anything to share?
Well, sure. And probably the most interesting story that I have comes with my mountain explorations with the one time too far. And that's kind of where basically I went hiking in the woods for what I thought was going to be a one-day backpacking trip and ended up being lost in the mountains for 4 days and then after getting turned around with blizzard conditions. And basically, on the day that I basically hiked 8 miles to the trailhead where the actual climb starts and ended up in a position where I was post-holing up to my waist in snow for almost a half mile, which basically, when that happens, what you think is going to take a half hour ends up taking 3 or 4 hours just to go like a half mile or a mile. And then you get to where you wanted to get to too late, and then all of a sudden there's a snowstorm and you completely lose sight of directions, and you just kind of have to go into to survival mode. And somehow I got turned around, went the wrong way, went down the wrong ridge line, and ended up 15 miles from where I should have been for getting back to the vehicle, and really just ended up in the middle of nowhere in the middle of March in the Colorado Mountains, and really was ended up having to figure out the right way to deal with like 4 days of wilderness survival in the middle of nowhere. So, and associated with that, is basically having fun with falling through holes in the snow, down little crevasses, all kinds of dealing with mini avalanches, all kinds of fun things with ways of that story. And I could probably go on for hours on that, but really, that was probably my best experience of pushing things too far and realizing where the line was for things too far, as well as fortunately I was also trained in many wilderness survival skills, from anything from snow caving to making fires to energy management. And of course, energy management, that kind of situation, is the most important thing you could do so you can properly manage your energy so you can get to where you need to get to so you can get yourself to a safe place. But Long story short, I was able to eventually work my way down the mountain valleys, figure out where I was, figure out where I needed to get to, do the appropriate navigation skills, and basically to get as low elevation as possible while aiming for a road. And I eventually was able to run into another hiker who helped me back to the trailhead, and he drove me to my vehicle and were, you know, 8 miles away because I came out of a different trailhead and was able to get out just fine. But again, that could have turned out very differently if number one, I didn't have the wilderness survival training skills ahead of time, and number two, if I had not realized when I was making really bad decisions and just stopped. And yeah, unfortunately, I've never been in a situation like that again because I learned an awful lot of, you know, when it's the right time to stop and turn around and do the right things. But that's probably the most, one of the more interesting things I've had happen to me in the past. So, now, of course, I've come across a lot of surprising, unexpected, and amazing things that are out there, but the problem is I live in an environment where a lot of those things are, you know, like regular everyday occurrences, and I don't even realize it at the time, so, and I don't tell many stories about it, so it's kind of hard to talk about. I guess another one has to do with, like, hacking the middle school Mac, where basically I would basically play a game with a librarian where in middle school every single day I will have figured out the root password for the computer system that was there. And basically this was done through about 15 or 20 different methods, and they couldn't figure out how it was going. And it was kind of, like I said, it was really a very interesting experience with playing a cat and mouse game with the computer IT structure. And I never understood that I was doing or why I was doing everything wrong. And I didn't realize how much I was really annoying people at the time. But long story short, and so, at least that was done in the back in the day where where it was considered more of a humorous thing to hack other people's machines as opposed to something that was negative or expellable thing. So, but that was one thing where you kind of go in, figure out the root password to the computer, and then it's changed the next day. They have a different protection mechanism. You figure out what it is the next day. And we played this like hack unhack game for almost 6 months before the librarian got sick and tired of me and just kicked me out entirely. But still, it was a really fun learning experience associated with that.
Now, we're down to our last few minutes of this interview, and so I'm going to compress the last couple of questions, and you can sort of decide Sure. how you want to answer them. You can choose a topic area, and then what do you see as the top challenges facing us today, and how do you propose they be solved? And I guess the last one is kind of more freeform. If there were sort of questions that you wanted asked and you were going to provide an answer, what would they be? So you can sort of flex and determine how you want to answer that, and then we'll close off the interview.
Sure, sounds good. I still think the number one biggest topic area that really needs to be discussed across the area, again, is cybersecurity, and it's very broken today. Airplanes are hacked, cars are hacked, vulnerabilities in a breathtaking range of sensitive equipment from TSA locks to voting booths to medical devices to everything. And, you know, again, you have former NSA Director Mike McConnell suspecting that China has hacked every major corporation in the United States and Canada and a number of other countries around the world. And now, really, how do you deal with that as an organization, especially when you realize that in some cases the U.S. government is trying to do the same things to you as per the Edward Snowden revelation, for getting the information that the government feels as though it needs to be able to defend the country against these kind of attacks, as well as against terrorism threats and information that may be stolen from networks. So, combined with the fact that it was estimated that approximately 110 million Americans, or about a quarter of the population of America, got their IDs in some way compromised in 2014, this is a major issue that's ridiculously broken, and the technology that's out there is not keeping up with where companies need to be, and most companies are just starting to realize how much threat they've actually are in the middle of and how much risk they're actually exposed to, because most companies don't even know that their data is being stolen, so how do you deal with it? So, and really, when it comes down to it, I think the solution to this space really needs to come down to three different things, and that's interoperability, being able to get, instead of individual companies with tools that really have no interface with each other, being able to rapidly move definition cipher capabilities between these various different capabilities, between the various different tools that you may need to defend your system, and these tools may include things like a threat sharing system, a endpoint protection system, a audit system, a and analysis environment. You know, there's various different classes of tools that all need to be combined together because there's no one vendor-fit-all solution. And all these tools need to fit together in a cohesive manner. They can't just all be individual stovepipes that require a lot of custom code and work to connect. Associated with this, you need to do a much better job of getting a shared cohesive body of knowledge of these threats so that a company can understand when they see a particular thing occurring on their network, what is the appropriate action they should take, and how they should be able to, what's the best remediation practice for it. Because that knowledge right now is very esoteric and really hidden behind a small number of experts in the field, and that a lot of this knowledge needs to become a lot more widespread so sysadministrators of average capability can take effective action instead of just system administrators of extraordinary capability. And the same thing has to do with basically when your threat and we see a certain type of threat, being able to share that in an effective way that allows for everyone to build on that knowledge and help dramatically, rapidly improve the ability for companies to take the appropriate actions to defend their users' data and their critical business data. And, of course, the other thing that's important with this, because you've got these disparate systems and the inability to connect the tools properly, you end up with an analysis and automation gap. So that really slows down your ability to both detect when things are occurring and take the appropriate responsive actions to these things. So how do you really the innovation needs to be, how do you put the right capabilities in there to enable either human in the loop or human on the loop type activity with either full or partial automation, and really with the end goal of being able to make decisions, affect the right decisions in as short a time frame as possible, and get away from these weeks or day time frame, or the days to weeks time frame that we currently have for detecting and defending against cyber attacks, and move it to ideally the seconds to milliseconds range, so that you're able to continuously defend as well as defend everywhere where your data is involved, not just the choke points where your data probably doesn't exist anymore. Because once you start putting data out to the Amazon cloud, the Google cloud, have pieces and parts running on Salesforce, all of a sudden your data is everywhere. So how do you deal with the protection of that, where there's really no one network checkpoint, no one or 10 network choke points you can rely on anymore for managing and viewing and understanding how your data is being utilized, or if anything unusual is happening with your data, and how to determine whether or not that unusual activity is just a data scientist running a strange query, or whether it's someone trying to actually steal your whole entire password database from your network. So you need to have the analysis capabilities in place, and right now I'm not aware of any solution that's out there right now, because that really is able to handle all three of those things in parallel, and that's an area that I'm trying to change right now, but I think it's an industry-wide problem that needs to be made forward right now, because we need to get away from everyone having a unique cybersecurity solution and getting to the point where we have at least a common set of standards where you can share data between those individual solutions and make it so the solutions start to look more common and interchangeable, rather than these individual stovepipes you have right now, which makes it so that data cannot be shared or be interchanged. And you're generally, once you deploy with one company, you're stuck with them forever, whether the right choice or not. And then lastly, this has to be accomplished by a mindset of change, saying that we've never been penetrated to, okay, we're being penetrated right now. How badly, how much can we mitigate this risk, and how much can we control the information flow while still being able to do the things we need to do to make money as a business? Because all companies effectively have been hacked to some degree. How do you, and instead of pretending like that's never happened, how do you deal with the reality that you're always going to have some information leaking to someone that you don't have? And then how do you, and once you understand that you don't have 100% protection, you can probably get 99% protection, how do you properly manage that 1% that might leak, and understanding where those interfaces that might cause that problem and where those might occur? So really going from the denial personality to really accepting hacking and data leaking as a fact of life, and then managing the risk as opposed to pretending like that risk doesn't exist in the first place, or even worse, buying cybersecurity insurance and pushing that risk off to a third party and just assuming that third party will take care of everything for you and make things nice. So really, cybersecurity is really going to be a key thing for helping make the world a much more protected place, and be able to ensure that people have control over their personal data, and they understand who has access to data for what person for what reason. So really, cybersecurity is really expensive and complex to do right, and we need a revolution in the space to be able to properly make it so it's affordable and accessible to everyone, not just the companies that are willing to spend, you know, $10, $20 million a year for protecting every single computer and interface within their company. How do we create a solution that's good enough that allows us to react faster than all these new and amazing cyber hacking capabilities that are coming out and that are coming out of the world so that, you know, you're actually able to defend yourself and stay ahead of the enemies as opposed to right now where the enemies are really getting advanced and far outstrip the capabilities of the systems you can currently buy off the shelf. And if you want to fill that gap, you more or less have to, you know, spend significant software engineering resources to do the integration yourself. So that's kind of where, kind of associated with that. And then, yeah, so really at the end of the day, that kind of plays into a larger concept where the cyber world is really flat. Everyone has a access to all the capabilities of everyone else. So how do you deal with that and manage that, the fact that everyone can have data everywhere at any given point in time, and how do you manage that data and use it for both, and both defend it and protect it from people and governments who want to use that data inappropriately, or how do you make it so that data becomes very powerful in an international sense? So it's a really interesting, complicated area that I'm really excited to see the innovations that are going to come out in the near future with that.
Well, Chris, that's a really in-depth explanation of what you're offering and what the pain points are and the challenges and also the solution. Excuse me. And I can see why you've made such outstanding progress in this area and you're considered a leader. Chris, again, thank you for coming in today. And I know your schedule is demanding, but you made time to spend explaining and sort of giving the insights about what's happening in the world in terms of innovation and trends and areas and threats that people have to be aware of, especially executives. And I really do thank you for doing that, to sharing your experiences with our audience.
Well, thank you very much, Stephen. The pleasure's been all mine. And to kind of put a footnote on everything I've talked about today, really it comes down to we have the technology to do incredible things today. We just need to focus on the integration between these technologies at the systems level to make it so that these technologies can do a better job of integrating in all parts of our lives.
And thank you for that. And I want to close by saying I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and this concludes our exclusive interview with Chris Howard, top global engineer, entrepreneur, who's passionate about transforming the world.